Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. So the kids down the hall from me just had a baby 5 days ago. Was it 4 days ago? I don't know. Yesterday they brought the baby home from the hospital. Here I am, teetering on the brink of what Raymond Chandler used to call the long goodbye, or imagining I am, or God knows wanting to be for various reasons. But and there's this baby being born down the hall. What a blessed refutation of my negativity, you know, a brand new baby born to two parents who really want this baby. These people are actually, they're in their, I call them kids because they're in their late 20s. To me, anybody under 30 is a kid. At this point, you know, you get to a certain decade and that's how it is. I'm almost 70. So, like I wouldn't call my program director a kid. I mean, I'm looking at him through the glass right now, and he's not a kid. He's a mature man, not elderly, but he's not a kid. But anybody under the age of 30 is a kid. So, and my kids are my kids, no matter how old they are. So they had a kid, and of all things, these kids are Mormons. They come from Utah, and they're Mormons. And it's almost like a spaceship landed on my in my hallway when they first moved in about a year and a half or 2 years ago, whatever it was. And they have all their friends over who I'm guessing probably are also Mormons. And they're a very happy kind of predominantly blonde crowd. And they do kind of stick out. They do sort of stick out in my building and in the neighborhood. But not really. You know, I mean, New York, everybody, right? Everybody. On the Upper West Side, though, all used to be all blacks, Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, Jews, leftover Irish from when it was almost entirely Irish, my neighborhood. to have Mormons there, it's very odd. But there are a good number of Mormons in the city. Not a lot of them. There are some Mormons in the city, and because they have this gigantic Mormon, I guess, I don't know what we call it, a tabernacle? Is that what they call it? Mormon church on 65th Street on Broadway, which is about 40 blocks from where I live. And their whole life revolves around that. But, you know, all that is neither here nor is it there. They are actually very nice people, very decent, good-hearted people, intelligent. And they've been planning on this kid. They're just overwhelmed with joy now that they have this kid. And there's this little boy. And here's this old boy. And this old boy was planning to talk about Thanksgiving. Don't turn off the show. Don't turn it off because I said Thanksgiving. I know that could be like the biggest downer there ever was. When you think of Thanksgiving, let's do it. Let's do the psychological test. When I say Thanksgiving, what do you think of? Think of eating too much. You think of having to be together with your crazy family, whether you want to or not. You think of how bleak everything is. You think of family, family, family. You think of your life. You think how it turned out, how it's turning out, how you want it to turn out, and how it's been overwhelmingly influenced by your family, you know, especially those closest to you. And Thanksgiving and the holidays in general, Thanksgiving and Christmas, but it all starts with Thanksgiving, which is the ultimate American family holiday. Essentially a secular holiday, although, you know, the first Thanksgiving was when is this from grade school that I remember this, or did I read this in Wikipedia, or what difference does it make? That the pilgrims came over and survived, you know, pilgrims being a very extreme sect of Christianity. They survived the first winter, and those who did survive, and then gave thanks after the first harvest, which probably they wouldn't have had if it wasn't for the Indians, who they later, along with everybody else who came from Europe, slaughtered. The Indians definitely don't want to hear Thanksgiving. They don't want to hear about Thanksgiving. So, you know, it was like they helped the original settlers survive up in Massachusetts, and for that, and probably down in Jamestown, is it, in Virginia? And for that, they reaped the benefit of tremendous, you know, genocide and slaughter and bigotry and whatever a lot of them have now. Except they have reason to be thankful because they have gotten licenses for casinos. So everybody's got a reason in the end to be thankful. But Thanksgiving so it was a religious holiday just because the people who first celebrated it in this country were so religious, and they thanked God, and in there is, you know, they thanked their Christian God for it, and they thanked God for their survival. They thanked God that they survived. Thank God for their lives, and they thanked God amongst their family and their friends. So this is what people think when they think of Thanksgiving. Now, I can't see your hands in front of me or your faces in front of me. Someday we'll figure that all out. There'll be some kind of mini Skype where I'll be able to see, you know, too much information, right? I'll be able to see everybody and everybody will be able to see me at the same time. And I hope not, because I like the radio the way it is. But what do you think of when you think of Thanksgiving? Are there people out there? And I'm sure there must be who you know, think of Thanksgiving as a wonderful time where they can just, first of all, you get time off from work, so that's a plus, right? You get a couple of days off from work, and you get to be with your kids if you don't spend too much time with your kids. Let's say you're working all day and, you know, you come home late at night or you come home at the end of the day and you just don't see your kids enough. They're in school. Well, that's okay. That's the way life goes. But then you can spend time with your kids. You can take them. But what's the other thing you think of? Black Friday. What Black Friday is now, there is no more Black Friday. Black Friday has spread like metastasized, like melanoma, to become Black Thursday, Black Wednesday, Black Tuesday, Black Monday. So the whole year is black now. Does black mean that the stores are in the black, that they sell so much stuff? That black ink is used for profit, red ink is used for a loss. Is that what black means? Because Black Friday, I always thought it was a strange word for it. Black Friday originally was the name given to the day that the stock market crashed in October of 1929. I forget when, but it crashed October 29th, right. I thought it was, but I didn't dare say it unless I knew. But now I have actual verifiable information from the guy who's not really a kid. So October 29th, 1929, was the stock market crash, and it crashed almost entirely in one day. You know how it can be, right? And that was called ever afterwards and still remembered by people who were around to remember it, and there aren't that many, but it was called Black Friday. And it was Black Friday because black often, fairly or unfairly, is the word people use when they're in a horrible mood. Say you're in a black depression. It was so black that I was terrified. I couldn't see. It was so black in the room. Black, 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 right? Although once Herman Melville turned the whole thing on his head and talked about how there was nothing more bleak and horrible and devil-like than the color white. Leave it to Herman Melville, who was a little bit nutty himself, right, who was possessed by black moods. And he decided to write a whole chapter of Moby Dick about the color white, about snow and about the white whale and how white was an awful, evil color. One of the reasons was because there was no variance, right? But that's the same thing. People use the word black all the time, saying I was in a black, foul mood. I was in a black depression. So Black Friday. And, you know, in the cowboy movies, the original cowboy movies from the 30s and the 40s until they got a little hipper, right? The bad guys, these crummy cowboy movies that they made in about 4 weeks. One cowboy movie studio could turn out 10 cowboy movies in a year, sometimes with the same characters. But the bad guys wore black, literally, and the good guys wore white. It had to be that way. They had a white hat. The guy with the white hat would rise into town, usually on a white horse. I think, didn't the Lone Ranger have a white horse? Silver was a white horse, right. Now, you know, the Lone Ranger's not going to ride in, although he had a black mask on. But that could be because he was, according to Lenny Bruce, that he was gay. You know, I don't really know, and who knows about the Lone Ranger. I think the guy's name. I listen to the Lone Ranger, by the way. I'm so old that I listened to the Lone Ranger on the radio. I did. Right around the time I listened to the Lone Ranger on the radio, and they had these great sound effects. I can't reproduce them here, but they had these like coconut shell halves, half coconut shells, that they did the sound of horses' hooves all the time. Whoa there, Silver. And the horse would go. And they had tremendous sound effects. So when I first listened to the Lone Ranger, when I first was aware of the Lone Ranger, it was on the radio, which was a big hit on the radio. The stars on TV, I feel I remember, may have been the same guys who were on the radio. The guy on the radio who played the Lone Ranger was Clayton something or other. But the guy on TV who played Tonto was Jay Silverheels, or Silverheel, I think, his name. But so I heard it on the radio first, and then I saw it on TV. And when you see it on TV, the first TV we had was, of course, black and white. It was black and white. And black and white have always been used, like in movies back in the 20s, you know, in before there were talkies, and even in the 30s, before they experimented with color, and still in the 40s when they were using black and white almost entirely, black was often the color of darkness, of fear, of evil, and white a silvery, kind of a silvery white was the color of, a day, the sun rising or a good time or decent people or something like that, or a decent person. In fact, one of the best movies I've ever seen like that was an early version, I think it was in the early 30s, of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. There have been various versions of that, but the best version of it is from 1931 or 33, somewhere in there, with Frederick March, who plays Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And in that, they use black and white so beautifully and so perfectly to portray the shift from good to evil, light and dark, I should say. It's not necessarily black and white, but sometimes black and white. But the shift between light and dark and the correspondence of light and dark and the comparison between the two, absolutely beautiful. If you get a chance to get this, if they have it on Netflix or something like that, or whatever you use to listen to watch movies, Hulu, Amazon, Roku, Zazen, Ramen, whatever you use to listen to TV, watch TV rather, get this, and it's really worth it. It's really great. One of the great tales of Victorian suppression of sex and of emotion among the upper middle and the upper classes in England. And this is the time of Jack the Ripper. And if you ever see these movies that are made about Jack the Ripper, or these movies are made about Victorian times, or even Dracula, which was written during the height of Victorian times, it's always darkness versus light. I mean, think of the vampire, right? The vampire only comes out at night. At night, when everything gets loose, when the bad things can happen, when things start happening that are bad. But I digressed. Where was I? I was talking about Thanksgiving, right? Thanksgiving is families. Thanksgiving is families. And people have, a lot of people, I should say a lot of people, not people, but a lot of people, probably as many as half or more of people. I mean, they've made movies about it. There's a movie called Home for the Holidays, which is about, and every time you see on TV, if there's an episode on TV or something in the movies where somebody went home for Thanksgiving, people get drunk, family secrets come out, people say things to each other which are outrageous or inappropriate, people act out, people, the bad brother or the bad sister or the crazy uncle or the depressed mother or the manic father. Somebody does something bizarre on Thanksgiving, and people get a churning feeling in their stomach, I should say. Some people get a churning feeling in their stomach. And I'm going someplace on Thanksgiving which is filled with really sort of nice people. They're not my family, they're my wife's family, but I know them for 25 years now, and this is generally where I go. My own family not really being in one place and not the kind of thing that I could call a gathering. And that's partially my fault, though, too, because I've been running away from my family my whole life. When I was a kid, my family didn't really exist. I mean, it wasn't really a family. It was to the extent that my grandma, to the point where my grandmother died. My grandmother died when I was 15. Until I was 15, she was the thing that held the family together. So if there was a Thanksgiving dinner, which she didn't necessarily approve of because she was so such a religious Jew in her own way, not pious or Orthodox, but, very Jewish identified, that she didn't like to have all this cooking done and these big family gatherings for some Americanish holiday, right? But she did it anyhow because the kids, right? Her kids, that is to say, my mother, my father was not in the picture. But, and for the grandkids, right? We were Americanized. So, we had to have Thanksgiving or else we would be freaks. Everybody on the block either went home someplace where they came from somewhere else. So they went home to the South or the North or the West or something for Thanksgiving. Or they had Thanksgiving in town. A lot of people who lived on my block when I was growing up were people who were from other parts of the city. That's, in other words, their families and even in their extended families, their grandparents, whatever, their parents, all lived in the city someplace. Usually it was the Bronx or Brooklyn. or Manhattan. We lived out in Queens, so people would go back to those places. So some of the houses were empty, but some people came to some people created their own Thanksgiving if their parents had died, or if they wanted to say, "Now I have my own family, and Mom and Dad, you can come here and visit us." Right, which was always a kind of a turning point in the life of the evolution of a family or of somebody who wanted to have a family. But since I had the only family in the neighborhood that was so dysfunctional, I mean, until my grandmother died, it was an imitation of a family. It was a good imitation of a family. My uncle came from Connecticut, where he ran away to get away from the rest of my family. But he came once a year to Connecticut, from Connecticut, to have Thanksgiving until his wife forbade him to come anymore because it was such a bizarre experience and depressing for his kids. And my aunt, who lived in New Jersey, she came. She was divorced, but she came. And my other aunt lived next door, so that was no big deal. And everybody was most of the people there were pretty good cooks. My grandmother and my aunt, especially the aunt from New Jersey. My mother and my aunt next door really weren't very good cooks. In fact, my mother was a terrible cook. She just didn't feel like making anything for anybody. My mother didn't want to give thanks or give anything to anybody. I mean, she was so committed, for good reasons, to her own survival. She was so self-involved and so self-concerned that she couldn't really give anything to anybody. And I'm amazed, and I applaud her from, you know, she's long gone, but I applaud her now when I think about it, time of remembering families, that she, being so scared of life and being so self-involved, managed to clean the house for everybody, managed make us dinner, sometimes as awful as it was, TV dinners or everything was burned, but managed to make breakfast. Sometimes she didn't manage to do that, but managed to put, like, when we were in elementary school, she would put little sandwiches in the sandwich boxes, stuff like that. But what I did was, since there was no father there, generally, and there was this crazy family, and everybody argued, and my mother, of course, appeared at the Thanksgiving feast like Banquo's ghost, you know, at the feast that Macbeth held. But she was real, and everybody could see her, not like a ghost that only Macbeth could see in Macbeth. And she was always, you know, these things were too much for her, as they are often too much for a lot of people. But for this poor woman, who could not tolerate other people at all, and everything was overwhelming to her, she never made it all the way through the meal, and she was capable of, and often did, destroy the entire, feeling of the mood of our Thanksgiving. She would fall apart or break into tears or start screaming or had to be taken to her room or whatever. So Thanksgiving was to me, and I know this happens for a lot of people, maybe not in such an extreme way, but Thanksgiving always was to me a kind of a horrible thing to endure. The opposite extreme was my father's family, who all loved their lives, who were big people, who ate a lot, who were jolly, who laughed, who all had big families of their own, who just loved the whole idea of family. So once or twice I went to Thanksgiving at their house, and that was just a wonderful thing. It was a warm, you know, we were over eight, you know, like everybody does on Thanksgiving, and it was delicious food. They were all good cooks because I like to give things to other people. In my family, such as it was, it's hard to call it a family, giving things to other people was a hard thing to do, which is something, unfortunately, I've inherited. I mean, when I was a kid entirely, forget about Thanksgiving, forget about it. I used to actually borrow other people's families on an average daily basis, and especially on Christmas morning. I always go over to my friend's house. They were really good Christian Baptists, and they had a tree, and I would open presents with them, and they didn't mind. I mean, maybe they hope someday that as lost little Jewish boy, I would see the light, and I would be recruited to the Christian soldiers' army. But they weren't. They didn't really, you know, push that. I mean, it wouldn't have been something that was appropriate, to say the least, in my neighborhood, which was mostly Jewish. But they liked having me over. Their son, I was their son's best friend, and they took pity on me because I had no real family at all. My father long gone. So since my father was gone and my mother was pretty much crazy or depressed all the time, I would borrow other people's families. So I have spent my whole life sort of like the wandering Jew, like a nomad, finding other families, and especially on Thanksgiving, right? I passed up the chance when I had my own family, when I had my own wife and kids, to create a family of Thanksgiving. I just couldn't do it. By that time, the poison of my earlier life was so solidified in my bones, and is sort of a little bit to this day, that even though I had to... wonderful kids, and I had a wife, and we were a family, and we invited other people over. I just couldn't, even when I had it, I couldn't deal with it, right? It was too much for me, and I guess I'm not the only one, though. I'm not the only one. I mean, there are a lot of people who can't handle their own Thanksgiving, you know, they can't invite people over, they can't assume the task of being in charge of a family, the mother or the father with the kids. It's very difficult for them to do that. A lot of arguments break out on Thanksgiving. A lot of melancholy occurs around it, sometimes afterwards. And then Thanksgiving is also the time when there's that parade. And so you can't, it's inextricable. The emotional family Thanksgiving nature of Thanksgiving, of giving thanks for what you have, for love, for family, for material things, for food, for shelter. I mean, in this world, right? You're lucky you even have those things. Even in this country now, you're lucky you have those things. But that's inextricably, like everything else in this country, bound up with commercialism. Absolutely impossible to separate from commercialism. And Thanksgiving has always been the Thanksgiving Day parade. When Santa and Mickey Mouse and now I don't even know. Who is it in the parade now? There are floats now. I don't know what kids. SpongeBob. Okay, SpongeBob. And what about, is he also wears square pants? He's the same dude, right? SpongeBob SquarePants. Sonic, who's it? Hedgehog? Sonic Hedgehog, his name is? Or like, okay, did you use initial? Mr. S. Hedgehog? No. Is it a Mr.? So we don't know. Is Big Bird? What about Big Bird? Did they have? No, don't know. Okay. And when I was a kid, it was, and, you know, my kids are there. You know, the one of them is 29. The other one's 34. I took them a couple of times to the Thanksgiving Day parade. And one time I had a lawyer who was sort of my agent when I was trying to make it in showbiz, who had an office on the third floor with a big window overlooking Times Square, which was a fantastic place to see these floats, because the floats would come, you know, like right next to you. In fact, it was a little crazily hallucinogenic, because every once in a while, if there was a wind, you know, a gigantic Mickey, a gigantic mouse or whatever, or or a kangaroo or some kind of dragon would just go right up to the window, like, and scare the living crap out of you, right? But and every once in a while, you see these poor people holding on, if it was a windy day, holding on to the floats. Once in a while, a float has gotten away or knocked something down and caused some casualties. But the whole idea of going there to that gigantic crowd, and I hate crowds. In fact, more than two people is a crowd to me. So I would, but I did the thing, you know, when the kids were little, I took them to the Thanksgiving Day parade and I picked them up on my shoulders, you know, and I lifted them up to see it. And then, interestingly enough, we lived on 76th Street and on the Upper West Side, which is right around the corner where they blew up and where they assembled the floats. So I took the kids when they were old enough, when it wasn't past their bedtime too much, when they were little, I took them to see, although maybe this was too much behind the scenes in show business, you know, took away the magic for the kids, but I took them to see Mickey Mouse get inflated, right? And I took them to see the floats being inflated and set up, and the whole, you know, float to carriage or whatever it was. It was an amazing experience, and everybody would do this. You'd get there about 9 o'clock, and they would start to inflate these things. It was fantastic. I did all that, but Thanksgiving, for me, Thanksgiving was, you say 20? I'm sorry. 20. Okay, so for me, Thanksgiving was an extreme, you know, I mean, my whole life has been extreme, but, you know, my growing up, which is still with me, which still sort of distorts things inside me, and makes it difficult for me, by the way, we're talking about Thanksgiving, we're talking about gratitude, makes it difficult for me to be thankful for anything. And I am a very, or I should say I'm a relatively, compared to most other people, ungrateful character. I am not the kind of person who gives thanks for things. Even though I have much in my life to be thankful for, I'm too negative to see it that way. And my whole life has been a struggle to try to understand that I have a lot to be grateful for. So Thanksgiving is a day which is perpetually has something to teach me. On the other hand, more hands here. Thanksgiving is not just for me the time of melancholy. It's a time when a lot of people check into mental hospitals. It's a time when, God forbid, worse things happen. And it's notorious for that. The holidays can make people very, very depressed and sad. Now, why is that? Not just because, it can't be just because everybody, no, not everybody grew up the way I did. But people, you grow up in a family and somehow, I don't know why it is. I guess I'm asking the question. I don't always have to have answers to things, right? One time I remember my son was 9 years old and he was asking me a question. And I always wanted to provide answers to my kids. So he asked me a question, and it was kind of a wondering out loud question. And he said, why, blah, blah, blah. So I start answering him, like Wikipedia. That's how I was all the time, right? And he says, you know, Dad, just because somebody asks you a question doesn't mean you have to answer it. This kid's like always a little, he was always like a little Buddha, you know, just naturally. What an interesting concept, right? In other words, you don't have to be in control all the time. You don't have to know everything. Take it easy. Relax. You know, I just asked a question out loud. It'll come to me one day. It's okay. You don't have to be in charge of everything. You don't have to know everything. It was actually a relief when he said that to me. But there is that thing. And so I'm asking this question out loud. What is it about Thanksgiving that can make people feel so pressured? Now, separate that from the insane people who are camping out at Walmart. There are people who have, you know, Black Friday's coming up. And actually now it's Black Thursday. They open up like right after the end of the Thanksgiving Day parade, which is in the mid-afternoon on Thursday. It's the time when everybody rushes. A lot of the stores open right then. Some of the stores open on Thursday morning, I think. But a lot of them open Thursday afternoon, Thursday evening. People get trampled to death, which happened at a couple of stores. I think it happened at one Walmart. Maybe it was out in Long Island someplace. Or somewhere else in the country. But people get trampled to death. People shove each other. Perfectly ordinary, innocent people who usually aren't violent bring. There are people who bring tasers and they bring pepper spray to these things. And, you know, you'll read about it in the papers. You'll see it again. It's inevitable. They shove each other. They knock each other down. People are arrested because they want to get that, whatever it is, you know, the new washing machine or the special doll, whatever it is this year that everybody has to have, or the chainsaw or something, right? They have to get it at the Home Depot or the Walmart. It's usually the Walmart. These department stores where everything is like 50% off, they're already low prices, right? Crazy Walmarts. Come in now for a low price. But so people, so separated from that, though, what is it about Thanksgiving and families that causes so many people to feel depressed and sad and regretful and angry? What is that? I'm just asking that question because certainly it does. Robert Frost said when he was talking about home, and this is a sort of just all part of the piece, he said, home is the place. This is a quote from one of his poems. Home is the place when you go there, they have to take you in. And Robert Stone, who wrote Dog Soldiers and a couple of other really great novels, in one of his novels called A Flag for Sunrise, which I could recommend reading, it's grim, but he's a beautiful writer. The main character in there was driving to another country through Mexico from the United States, and he was thinking about his family and how difficult it was for him to be a father and a husband. And he said, the family is an instrument of torture. The family is an instrument of torture. Families can make you crazy.
Oh, there's no place like home for the holidays. 'Cause no matter how far away you roam, when you pine for the sunshine of a friendly gaze, for the holidays, you can't beat home, sweet home. I met a man who lives in Tennessee. He was heading for Pennsylvania and some homemade pumpkin pie. From Pennsylvania, folks are traveling down to Dixie's sunny shore. From Atlantic to Pacific, gee, the traffic is terrific. Oh, there's no place like home for the holidays. 'Cause no matter how far away you roam, if you want to be happy in a million ways, for the holidays, you can't beat home, sweet home.
Take a bus, take a train, go and hop an aeroplane. Put the wife and kiddies in the family car. For the pleasure that you bring when you make that doorbell ring, no trip could be too far.
I met a man who lives in Tennessee. He was heading for
Pennsylvania and some homemade pumpkin pie.
Some pumpkin pie.
From Pennsylvania, folks are traveling down to Dixie's sunny shore.
From Atlantic to Pacific,
gee, the traffic is terrific.
Oh, there's no place like home for the holidays. 'Cause no matter
remember when you ran away and I got on my knees and begged you not to leave because I go berserk? Well, you left me anyhow, and then the days got worse and worse, and now you see I've gone completely out of my mind. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha, they're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha, to the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time, and I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats, and they're coming to take me away, ha-ha! You thought it was a joke, and so you laughed when I had said that losing you would make me flip my lid. Right? You know you laughed. I heard you laugh. You laughed, you laughed, and laughed, and then you left. But now you know I'm utterly mad. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha. They're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the happy home with trees and flowers and chirping birds and basket weavers who sit and smile and twiddle their thumbs and toes, and they're coming to take me away, I cooked your food, I cleaned your house, and this is how you pay me back for all my kind, unselfish, loving deeds. Huh? Well, you just wait, they'll find you yet, and when they do, they'll put you in the ASPCA, you mangy mutt. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha, they're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha, to the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time.
time, and I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats, and they're coming to take me away. To the happy home with trees and flowers and chirping birds and basket weavers who sit and smile and twiddle their thumbs and toes, and they're coming to take me away. To the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time, and I'll be happy to see those nice young men.
So you see, it's possible that there are different reactions. Different feelings about Thanksgiving. And sometimes I suppose two of them are mixed, right? When you go, I know how it is for a lot of people. When it depends what generation you're in, right? When a lot of people in their 40s and 50s say, now I'm going to be 70 years old, although I sound like a, I know I sound like I'm 25. That's the way the radio goes. That's how it is if you have, you know, certain radio chops and, you know, I mean, the technology. But, you know, when you're in your 40s, when you're in your 30s or 20s, let's say 20s, 30s, and 40s, and by that time maybe you, you know, you have a kid or you have two kids or you've been married or you're not married, you go home still. Or maybe even in your 50s, you still go home because your parents are alive. And your parents, if they practice this... this holiday, if they were the ones who always maintained and they were alive and they were a family, they were the ones, since you were a little tiny kid, since you were a baby, they were the ones who were your family. They were mommy and daddy. They were mom and dad. And that's where you go when you're in your in your 20s, you know, back from college, or in your 20s, if you're living someplace, let's say you moved far away or you moved to a different part of town someplace, you go home and you celebrate Thanksgiving with them, or in your 30s or in your 40s. And it's different depending on what generation you're in. You may still be like a child when you're in your 20s. You go home and you may have the same arguments that you did when you were a teenager or something. Then you get to be in your 30s and some life's disappointments start to set in. Maybe if you're a woman, and this is the societal norms, if you're a woman, you're not married, and you know, some of your other friends are married and they have kids, but still you have to go home, and then your mother or your aunts or your grandmother or whoever's around says, so when are you going to get married? You can bring a man home one of these days, or a woman or something? Are you gonna get together with somebody? So one day maybe I'll have grandchildren. They pile it on, right? They pile it on. You remember? Then you get to be. It could happen for men too. You know, a man comes home and he's like 38 years old, and he still he still hasn't gotten married, or he got married and he had a kid and he got divorced, or he got married and he got divorced without the kid, and he comes home and they say, "So is there anybody else?" The implication being like you're about to enter the door of hell in 2 years when you're 40 and you still haven't managed to grow up. I had a supervisor in the welfare department, Mr. Baldwin, one of my substitute fathers that I've found most of my life. I was in my mid-20s and he was about in his late 40s, a really solid, decent, good man. And he was, he took a liking to me, and I was kind of like a son to him. I spent a lot of time in his office. He was a case supervisor, which is one level higher than just a supervisor. He had his own big office. And, he once told me he went home for the holidays. His, family lived down in South Carolina. He lived up in St. Albans in Queens, which is this really nice neighborhood with big, beautiful houses. And, you know, he had built a good life for himself. He and his wife were both middle-level civil servants, and they were intelligent, decent, good-hearted people. But he told me when he went to, he came back from visiting his mother and father, and he said, you know, Mike, I'm going to be 50 years old, but it doesn't matter how old you are. When you go home to visit your mother and father, no matter how old you are, you're like a child again. And he says, there's nothing you can do about it. You can resolve that you're going to act like a grown person. You're going to be mature. Within half an hour to about 2 hours, they get to you. The whole atmosphere, the house maybe you grew up in, they get to you. And I think that's true for a lot of people. So Thanksgiving. My attitude is, and this is, again, I am the last person in the world. So, of course, that's what I'm doing today, right? I'm the last person in the world to be talking about or speculating on the idea of being thankful and on Thanksgiving. Because I have, all my life has been a struggle. Let me get a little water here. And I'm thankful I have this water. I am. See, that's the idea. You're supposed to be thankful for the little things, because the little things, when you add them all up, it's the thing, right? The little things are the thing. Not supposed to have silence on the radio. A little silence on the radio isn't bad. Let's try it. Let's be thankful for a little silence in our lives that are so full of noise and graphics that you can't ever get away from it. That's nice, right? Something to be thankful for. So, my life I could define probably as a struggle to be grateful for the things that I have been given or that I have now, and that I am not grateful for, that I don't give thanks for. And of course, not being, I wish I was, but not being faithful, that is to say religious, I cannot give thanks to God for the things I have. But sometimes I teeter on the brink. Maybe it has to do with mortality, the older I get. I have a friend who's my age, and he's a pretty religious Jew. And I'm not sure if he does this, but I knew another guy who was also an extremely religious Jew. And it may have been him or it may have been somebody else. He said, every morning when you wake up, as soon as you're conscious that you're awake again, you give thanks to God that that he gave you your life back again, because he's got your soul in his keeping. You know, now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. Right. Presumably your soul is not under your control. You don't have possession of it firmly, at least when you're asleep. It wanders around. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. I always assume what that means is that it doesn't go to the devil, right? That resides in the bosom of the benevolent Lord. I mean, this is isn't that something that that was taught to kids as a prayer to say? You know, these little Norman Rockwell scenes when kids are kneeling by their beds from the 30s and 20s and 30s and 40s. And that was a prayer that kids said, or that they said with their parents. It's kind of scary and creepy, the idea that when you're asleep, it could make somebody like me not want to go to sleep. If I'm going to go to sleep, and I have trouble sleeping, so maybe that's it. When I go to sleep, I'm afraid that anything might happen to me. You know, it's dark, and unfortunately, this is based on some experiences I had when I was a kid, which have haunted me my whole life. But, you know, the idea of this darkness and sinking into it, naturally, kids, all kids, if you've ever had a kid, you know, most kids just don't want to go to sleep. Almost every kid cannot stand the idea. They get scared and upset about having to go to sleep. But, you know, if they're there with a decent parent or parents, and you read them a story, and it's naturally their biological rhythm. And I mean, ran around all day long. They're wiped out, depending on how old they are, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. They want to go to sleep. You know, their body wants to go to sleep. But kids are scared to go to sleep. They don't want to separate from you, and they don't want to be in the dark. In the dark, because your soul is wandering around. If I should die before I wake. I mean, who knows what goes on when you're asleep? You're not in control. A diversion, a digression. But so my friend said, as soon as you wake up in the morning, you thank God for your life. Well, sad to say, in my own case, I don't speak for everybody, that there have been many times in my life, and after this heart attack I had approximately a year ago, the anniversary is coming up, which gives me the creeps, I have to say, which almost killed me and has actually altered my life, not for the better, kind of wiped my life clean, like a slate that was wiped clean. When I wake up in the morning, I have had occasion sometimes in my life, and sometimes I still do, especially since what happened last year, not of thanking God that he allowed me to wake up and gave me my soul back, but of cursing God. Now that's, you know, like I say, I'm my show is here as an extreme form of something. Whatever I'm talking about, it's usually an extreme. I assume that you place yourself along either not in my league at all, not in, you're not even playing the same game of whatever it is I'm doing, but you're on some continuum, right? If you feel as extreme as I do about most things, I'm sorry to hear it, and I hope that you keep taking your medication. But then there's and you think, what is there to be thankful for? Then, of course, but of course, there are a million things to be thankful for. There are a million things to be thankful for. Less and less and less, perhaps, as you get older, and as life perhaps didn't work out for you the way you wanted to be. I mean, if you have spent your whole life at a job that you didn't like, if you're unemployed for a long time, if you've been downsized out of some place, that's not good. And then let's say you get older. There's older people in my building. They have been married for 50, 60 years, and then one of them dies. So there's aging. There's mortality, right? And mortality doesn't come to everybody like, you know, like a blissful fluttering of angel wings. And one moment you're alive, and the next minute you get 5 minutes to say goodbye. You have no pain, right? Generally speaking, aging and mortality are scary, painful propositions. And you get older and older and older. So if you wake up and you've got arthritis, and you've got this, and you've got that, and you've got worse things, and you wake up in the morning, do you really want to thank God for your life? Is that what you're thankful for? But you might be thankful for the fact that you're not out on the street suffering, that you're in, that you have Medicare. Thankful. Let's be thankful for Medicare, which, of course, the Republicans, now having been elected in the majority of both houses and probably will be president, they want to toss that right to Wall Street, to their pals on Wall Street. And good luck. All Social Security and Medicare will be handled by private companies. Forget about the Affordable Care Act. We're going to go straight backwards if they get a Republican president. January 20th, whenever the shift happens and the Congress becomes entirely Republican. And then in 2016, the odds are very good with this namby-pamby, backboneless, nowhere president that we have. I mean, one of the reasons that people voted so much for the Republicans is because this president is such a failure as a leader and somebody who has no passion and somebody who takes no chances. I mean, look at him. He's talking about we're going to be out of Afghanistan. We're going to be out of Afghanistan. Well, maybe, you know, we'll keep a couple of troops there. Now he's going to send more troops to Afghanistan. Am I having a bad dream when I read this? Is that really true? Did they actually print that in the newspaper? Is this chicken-livered, pseudo-Republican son of a bitch going to send troops into Afghanistan? I mean, why? Why not? Why not just? Forget about it. You know, I mean, I'm getting more interested in politics. It took me a year to pay attention to politics at all after the heart attack I had. So it's been such a hard year, and it's been such a terrible year for me, and there's been so much pain mentally and physically that I'm not in the mood to be thankful. And this has happened to me before in my life, but I cannot, and I hope I don't, speak for everybody. And people have things to be thankful for. There are so few jobs these days. If you're old, if you're in your 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and you lose your job, good luck finding another one. So if you have found another one, and it's not what you want, of course, probably, but you have to be thankful for that, right? Well, you don't have to be, but you should be thankful for it. And if you have a job, even better, if you have a job that's interesting, I mean, that's really something to be thankful for, right? But if you're not religious, who do you thank for the things you have? Who do you thank for the things you have? Do you thank, do you thank the universe, some sort of gauzy, hazy concept like that? There are people who say, I thank the universe. And I don't mean just those words like that, but I've done that in my life. You know, you just thank, it's like a roll of the dice, right? You thank your luck Some people thank fate, which is a sort of a version of what happens in the universe. Only it's, I love the way the Greeks made everything. They personified everything. They anthropomorphized everything. So the fates were, I think, what, three sisters? who had a spinning wheel, and for every person in the world, these three sisters were able to do this. You know how God watches every sparrow, the fall of every sparrow, whatever it is. God sees a lot of stuff, right? Like the NSA. God's like the NSA. God knows what's going on. You know, on Christmas they have that song, You Better Watch Out, You Better Not Cry, You Better Not Pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. He sees when you were he knows when you were sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good. So be good for goodness sake. It sounds like the goddamn NSA and the CIA. Is Santa Claus actually a covert operative running a check for the NSA on everybody? He knows when you're sleeping. He knows if you've been bad or good. Really? I don't even know if I've been bad or good. But Santa Claus knows. I think that's too much knowledge for one fat, you know, red-suited, bearded guy who lives in the North Pole who actually enslaves reindeers. That's too much for a person to know. That really is. Anyhow, memories of childhood. That's why Thanksgiving is difficult, because you have memories of childhood. You had hopes. You had wishes. Because of your parents' faults, they weren't really... I hate to say this because people don't want to hear it all the time, but they weren't absolutely responsible for the way they treated you. They did their best. I mean, I think about my mother now, who was so crazy and so mean and vicious. My father, who pulled the massive disappearing act of all time. They did their best. They did what they could. They just weren't suited to be parents. And it's a hard thing to be a parent. It's a hard thing. And now you know yourself, being a parent or even a grandparent, how hard it is. That's when you start to forgive and you start to be thankful. And then you can be thankful for little things. When you get older, you're thankful for a day without pain. You're thankful for a few hours without pain. These days in this world, if you're thankful, if you have a place to live, if you have food to eat, if you have some heat to see you through the winter, and an occupation, of course, an interesting job. And after all, you should be thankful for even a moment of peace, even a glimmer of love.
At a time when this world just seemed to be spinning really out of control, there were some believers, deceivers, a few in betweeners who seemed to have no place they could go. Same old song, it's right and you're wrong. Living's just something you're going through. No place to hide. I fell into your eyes and I found myself in you. Look to the stars, Lord, and roar to the bars. To my life, it got up and flowed. With my hands on the wheel, there's something I know is real. I know that of an oak down by the river, you see an old man and a boy. They're setting sails, they're spinning tales. He's probably telling him about some whales.
laughing with a lady that they enjoy. Yeah, it's the same damn tune. It's the man in the moon. It's the way that I feel since I found you. 'Cause I had no place I could hide. I looked into your eyes and I found myself in you. I looked to the stars, I busted up some bars. I saw my life as a joke, but with my hands on the wheel, something that's so real, I know that I'm headed home.